Hi, this is Joe Mama. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, we are replaying a broadcast from last year about the KCMO police killing of Ryan Stokes. It has now been over 4 years since this incident and over a year since his family filed a federal lawsuit against the KCPD asking for the investigation to be reopened. In the first part of the show, I spoke with Ryan's family and friends about who Ryan was, and in the second part, Keith Brown-Ill spoke with his mother, his best friend, and attorney Cynthia Dodge about the night Ryan was killed and the immediate aftermath. Stay tuned for the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. But before we go to our interviews, we're going to play a news report by Mike Murphy on two of the recent rallies here in KC.
On Saturday, a rally was held at Eilis W. Davis Park in coordination with rallies held all across the country called Millions for Prisoners' Rights. Here in Kansas City, participants were surprised to see several people show up in camouflage and with assault weapons and form a perimeter around the rally in the park. The militia folks, who identified as 3 percenters, had said that they were there at the request of the Kansas City Police Department. No violence ensued, and soon the rally turned into a march through the downtown Kansas City judicial neighborhood, making stops at various key landmarks. Here's Keith Brown-Ill in front of the Jackson County Courthouse.
This is where you come to have your trials, to be prosecuted, and then sent to prison. This man right here, this animal, genocidal maniac, murdered countless numbers of Indians and other people of color. This is America's hero, Andrew Jackson. He's on your $20 bill. Now, we hope one day that we can talk to people here in Kansas City and Jackson County into doing what other people have done, you know, taking down their Confederate flags and things of that nature. We'd like to get this statue away from this courthouse. We don't feel like he should be somebody that's a symbol of what justice stands for.
Yeah,
because there was nothing just about this man. You don't have to take my word for it. Read his history. You know, there are a lot of places that you can go to in Kansas City that have names of people like this who were slave advocates, who did want to see other people have equal rights. J.C. Nichols is one of them out there on the plaza.
The following day, at J.C. Nichols Fountain out there on the plaza, another rally was held called No Place for Hate. Hundreds of people showed up for that one. And yes, the 3 percenters were also there. And yes, they reiterated that they were there at the request of the Kansas City Police Department. This rally was organized by a 17-year-old young woman.
Yeah. So, last Saturday, August 12th, there were Nazis and KKK members marching hand in hand in our streets. Not just Charlottesville streets, our streets! And that's a problem! Our streets! Our streets! Alright, so, continuing on. The reason that this type of fountain and Charlottesville are connected is because when you have these types of monuments, it's easy to say that Charlottesville is about the goddamn statue. We know it is not about the statue. It is about white supremacy. Yeah! That's a letter to President Trump, by the way. So first off, I'd like to say, well, not first off. I'd also like to add, sorry, that white supremacy is terrorism. The KKK is terrorism. The alt-right is terrorism, Mr. President! Mr. President, this is terrorism. These are not criminals and thugs. These are white supremacists, and they need to be addressed as such.
Missouri State Representative Deron McGee of the 36th District.
It's really important that we come together about the issues that have happened over the last couple of weeks. We all know that these Confederate symbols are hatred. They're demoralizing to any group in this country. And we cannot allow these monuments to stand in any city, in any part of our country.
For KKFI, I'm Mike Murphy.
It's been almost 3 years since Ryan Stokes was shot and killed by a KCMO police officer. The officer said that he had seen Ryan with a gun and had shot him when Ryan turned towards other officers. A grand jury cleared the officer and said it was a justified shooting. The problem was that when Ryan was rolled over by the officers after being shot, the only thing he had in his hands were car keys and a flip phone. There was a gun in the car next to where Ryan was standing, but even some of the officers never saw a gun in Ryan's hands. Today, we are going to talk with Ryan's family about who he was, what he meant to his family, friends, and community. Then, in the second half of our broadcast, we will talk about the night that Ryan was killed and the lingering questions about the police story and the efforts of his family and friends to get justice for Ryan. I'm Jeff Humfeld, and today we are here with Nareen Stokes, Ryan's mother, Crystal, Ryan's sister, Moni, Ryan's cousin, and lover, his best friends. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio, everybody.
Thank you.
Hello.
We want to start out by talking about who was Ryan Stokes, to allow those that knew him best to put a face on this young man. And I'm going to start with you, Mrs. Stokes. Every child kind of plays a role within the family. Mm-hmm. Some of them are the smart aleck. Others are kind of introspective or outgoing. What kind of child was Ryan as he was growing up?
Ryan, to me, was full of life, full of joy. I was so happy to have a boy. When they told me I was having a boy, it was just like me and Ryan connected from him being inside of me to him coming outside of me. It was all good. Ryan Lee Stokes, I never forget it. I knew his daddy didn't want a junior. His daddy's name is Clarence, but he said he didn't want a Clarence Jr., so he told me that I could get the first name and just give him his middle name. So Ryan just came up to mind. Ryan Lee Stokes.
There's all sorts of things that happen within families as children are growing up. Mm-hmm. Are there a particular incident, you know, that you can think of that really shows who this child was as he was growing up?
I just saw him as like all boy to me because he had so many sisters older than him and he had girl cousins. So he had a big point to prove that he was the man, the little man of the house, of the family. He made sure he was going to let you know that he was a boy. And just because all those girls were around, that didn't mean nothing to him.
Did he have a particular, like, traits as a child? I mean, was he the peacemaker or was he the, like I said, the, you know, the smart aleck?
No, he was more the peacemaker.
Yeah.
He was more just a listener, and we knew that he was his own leader. He wasn't a follower. He was the leader, and he was the youngest, but he thought, I guess he wanted to be the oldest. He wanted to tell everybody that he was, like I said, we called him the little man of the household.
Crystal, you were Ryan's sister. You are Ryan's sister. What was your relationship with Ryan as you were growing up? I mean, with all the girls around and this one boy, I'm sure there were some pretty interesting incidences that came about.
They consider me to be the favorite sister to Ryan.
As far as the favorite sister, what does that mean? In other words, did you hang out?
We talked every day from 10 to time I got off. We would take our lunch breaks together and everything of that sort. Yeah, we was just like literally inseparable.
Well, when you were little though, were you that
close? I was his twin. Yeah, we were the same height, almost the same weight. So they thought we were twins.
That sounds like it was a lot of fun. Did you fool them a few times and tell them that you were twins?
Yeah.
One of the things that I've read, and I haven't seen much about it, was that Ryan did have a daughter.
Yes.
A child. And how was he with his daughter? Did he dote on her? Or was it, oh gosh, another girl in the family, I wanted a boy?
No, he didn't. He, as long as she was healthy, or the baby at the time was healthy, 10 fingers, 10 toes, image of him, he was perfectly fine. As long as he had him a healthy baby, and from that moment when she was here, he was like, that's my daughter.
Were there any particular incidences that you remember with him, with her, that just epitomized how he felt about his daughter?
Well, he kept, he got her like every other weekend, and like the weekends he had her, he was inseparable with her. Like, he had that relationship. He wanted his daughter to know who he was.
Moni, you're Ryan's cousin.
Yes.
Cousins are those folks that are friends, but there's more than friends. There's more of a bond there. What kind of a relationship did you have with Ryan? And
me and Ryan had a playful, lovable, sometimes hate relationship, growing up, especially because I remember me and him having a fight when we was younger. And him telling me, respect your elders, respect your elders. And I'm looking at him like, you were born in October, I was born in December. Not much of a difference. But it was crazy. That was one of our most memorable moments. But he was my go-to person. He was loyal. I could talk to him pretty much about anything. Whether I needed to cry, smile, laugh, whatever, I could always call Ryan. YouTube videos, him and my sister always was on YouTube 24 hours a day, sending videos back and forth to people. So when he passed away, I guess we kind of missed that, because sometime when I ride to work and I'm going, one day I was riding to work actually, and I went, I go towards their house, and I actually was going to their house one morning, and I was like, I'm tripping. And then, I don't know, I miss him, I can say that.
What was it like when all the family gathered together? Do you guys get together, big picnic or whatever, once or twice a year or something or other?
All the time.
It's dull.
Dull now, but when he was there,
Non-stop laughter.
Non-stop fun, talking.
He was the prankster of the family.
Yeah, he was a prankster. And he loved, if the food wasn't right,
he'll tell you.
The food wasn't right, he'll tell you.
He'll say, who made that?
He also tell us what the menu was going to be, what he wanted, and everybody was supposed to agree with it.
Did he cook himself?
Yeah, he learned. Yeah. Yeah, he couldn't. I told him, don't criticize if you can't, try to do it yourself and make a little mess up yourself. But he was more the barbecuer. He wasn't a vegetable man. He tell me, Mama, you got to do the vegetables. I'll do the meats, so. And they had him and his friend Lover, they had cooked up this picnic one year. And they brought all the meat to get seasoned. Mama did it, and I couldn't believe it, but they put it on the grill, and they didn't burn it up. So.
So. All right.
Yeah.
Talking about Lovey, Lover, I'm sorry. I don't know where I'm getting this Lovey from. Talking about Lovey, you're one of Ryan's best friends. Why don't you give us a little bit of a breakdown on what your relationship was, how you guys fit together, and what you did when you were together.
I don't know if I could tell you about all that. But, yeah, I mean, of course, he was my best friend. Like, so we talked every day, like I said, like every day. So stuff like that you miss, because it'll be the simplest phone call. Like, he'll just call me, what you doing, bro? Nothing, I'm just chilling. I'm at the cleaners, I'm going to call you back. Just that simple, you miss stuff like that. And, you know, of course, we played ball together. You know, we used to play on Tuesdays and Thursdays at the Southeast Community Center. Of course, we was, like, raised up there playing ball with the older people at the time. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we still carried on, kept playing. We played up until his death. We still play, the rest of us. But, yeah, I mean, that's a big piece out of our team, you know, that's missing. But, yeah, that was our shooter. So, you know, we out there playing without him on the court. Like, we still got jerseys and stuff made with a patch on it, you know, still showing that he's a piece of the team. So, yeah.
War stories. You should hear the war stories, Jeff, of the ball. The ball. Them two would get worked up, you know. But they loved each other. I knew they never fought. They just
Right. Yeah, man. I remember one night we was in the basement arguing at the house. We in the basement arguing about Allen Iverson, because Allen Iverson, my favorite player, he liked Tracy McGrady. And we just argued. He like, man, Allen Iverson would not make the Hall of Fame. I said, man, he's first ballot. Mom's woke up. She comes downstairs. Y'all are entirely too loud. People got to work in the morning. Oh, man. Yeah. But it was just nights like that. You know, we miss.
And who's the little one that we hear down there in the...
This is Carson Ryan, which is my son, Moni.
Moni's.
And he's named after Ryan. So... Yes, this is Carson.
You're a boy among girls. You better watch out. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what Ryan's role was within his community? Lever talked about playing ball together and all, but I believe you were also involved with the church.
Yes, he was active with the church for us. It's always been sports. Ryan loved basketball. He did tithe. I believe he had a faith that nobody could touch. He wasn't a true religious fanatic, but he believed in God. I know that, and he wore this cross all the time. I mean, never, hardly ever took it off, mainly for shower. But he was in you know, the church helping and cleaning the minister's suits and just involved. He kept himself really busy.
He went to church on a regular basis.
Yeah,
and stuff,
he was baptized. I remember he was baptized, but he was there. Yeah, he went to church on a regular. He went. He didn't just go on holidays and Mother's Day and Easter.
Yeah.
So he was raised to, you know, we had to get that religion.
You know, what other kind of activities was he involved in, you know, outside the church and the
Now, believe it or not, he played for the police academy. Didn't you play for him, too, Larry?
Or the Powell League?
Yeah. And we got trophies. And, yeah, they won. He helped them. I mean.
But KCPD created an image of somebody totally different.
Yes, they did. Right. And the media. And that's one of the things I was getting ready to talk about, was the fact that
we
vilify folks in the media.
Right.
Even before they've been convicted of anything.
Right.
And in cases like this, too often the media, they take the pictures that they're given from the authorities and they don't go to the family as much as they should. Right. They don't listen as much and really dig into who this person really was.
Right.
And I think that hurts when it gets to court, too, if it's somebody that's charged with something.
Yes.
I want to ask Crystal a little bit of something here, if can. When he came around and this boy was all of a sudden in this family of all girls, What did you, you know, how did you and your sisters take that intrusion, so to say?
Well, I was like a mother hen to him, so that was my baby. Once he came along, it was me playing dress up with him like he was my Barbie doll. Or at the time, he had like curly hair, so I would like do little stuff to him, rollers, and and just like mess with him, barrettes and everything else. So that was.
Yeah, I know that all too well. I've been there. Moni, do you have anything else that you really want to say about Ryan and what missing him in your life now is going to mean going forward?
Well, Ryan, he's just not the person that the media portrayed him to be. He's far from that person. Basically, that's why my family is trying to stand up and speak out about who he actually was, because the media tend to slander people and not even know that person. I mean, you never know what people, you know, are really going through inside for you to sit there and kind of like just slander one of their family members' name, especially somebody who
was ambitious and intellectual.
Like, yeah.
He,
like,
had his own mind. He wasn't
a follower.
Yeah.
He was far from that.
He had a game plan if he wanted to get his own business. You know,
That was actually, Crystal, you were just saying that he had a game plan. That was one of the things I was going to ask, and I was actually going to ask Nareen here, was that what did he want to be when he was a child, and what did he want to be?
He wanted to be, as a kid, he wanted to be a NBA player. But as an adult, when he grew up, he wanted to be his own boss. You know, he wanted to run his own cleaners. He wanted, you know, to open up a laundromat. He wanted to open up a dry cleaner business. He wanted to do a car wash. He wanted to just, you know, be his own person, you know, do stuff that he liked, he enjoyed doing, which was, you know, he knew he could do clean people's clothes and make friends at the same time. He had an interest for cars, so he wanted to open a car wash, you know, or a detail shop. You know, he wanted to really do stuff that he loved doing.
And that he enjoyed.
We're getting close to the amount of time that we have for this part of the show. So if any of you have something else that you'd really like to say about Ryan, what this loss means to you. You know, there's a hole that's going to be there for a long, long time in your lives. You learn to, you know, you never really get over it, but you get along with it.
You just try to keep going, right. But it's a big hole. It's a cut that just seems that it's not healing. It's missing him and thinking about him, you know, daily. And for as me, Mother Day is coming up. So that was my only boy, you know, to have a connection with a true son, or a son that loved his mother and his mother loved him as I loved him and I know he loved me. They don't know what hurt when I say, you know, the police, the mayor, chief, or whoever that doesn't want to connect and talk to us. I don't think they really know or they'll ever understand what they did to us here.
It was a major loss, basically, for our family. It was a major loss. That's all I can really say. Ryan was basically like the mold to everything. And as you stated before, you don't really ever get over the fact that they are gone. You just have to learn to keep coping with it. Like, literally, for probably about a year after Ryan passed, I probably woke up at 3:17 a.m. every night. Until I had to just wake up and just lay there. And sometimes I would just talk to God and ask God to give me strength to keep going, to embrace the loss that my family took. Give me the strength to be there and stand for my auntie, because Ryan and I were so close. When you seen him, you seen me, basically, especially with us growing up and me and him being the same age bracket, same friends, mutual friends. It was just always... I was always in the same vicinity as him. I don't really go out too much no more at all, because every time I went out, he basically was with me. But now I don't feel comfortable going out because I don't have nobody who I feel that was my protector at the time when I would go out somewhere. So I don't go. But, I mean, yeah, it was a major loss for us.
Lever, do you want to tell us a little bit about what kind of hole this is in the community and among his friends?
Oh yeah, it definitely was a big hole in our friendship, because it's five of us. So it's me, Fatback, Ryan is Fatback, then Tyrone, Chester, and Dan. You know, like, everywhere we go, it was always us, and we, all the courts we played at, you know, it's all five of us, 5-on-5, we running everybody, every gym, making everybody mad because we running their gyms, you know. And then, you know, we did other stuff like bowling. He was good in bowling. Even though I wasn't that good at the time, you know, I still talk my trash, you know. But he knew how to do it. It's a hole there now, you know, because he was a big piece of our friendship. Like, you know, like we never did nothing without him. So, you know, like after it happened, we over to the house every day, all day. Like, same thing, you know, I couldn't believe it. Like, I wake up, you know, out of my sleeps, you know, just thinking about it, dreaming about him. He talking to me in my sleep, all kind of stuff, you know, and it hurts. It hurts bad.
He was truly that ear, that shoulder, and that right hand.
Whatever you needed, like if I need a couple of dollars here, okay, say my daughter ain't got no Pampers, he's like, man, I got you, bro. You ain't even got to worry about that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he's a helping hand off the flip.
He was a true family person. No matter if you was a friend, but if you was a friend there, you was a friend for a lifetime, you know, good judgment.
Well, we want to thank you very much for coming in and talking about Ryan. I, you know, until we start putting faces and families behind the victims of these shootings, whether they be by the police, whether they be by somebody else in the neighborhood, we're just not going to change. We're not going to change.
And that's what hurts me a lot, Jeff, is because I always was the mother praying and worried that something else or somebody else would do something, but never thought the people that took the oath to protect and serve us would be the ones to take my son's life.
Well, we are out of time for this part of the broadcast, but I want to thank all of you. Of course, Nareen, Ryan's mother, Crystal, Ryan's sister, Moni, Ryan's cousin, and Lover, his best friend. Thank you. Some of these folks will be sticking around talking with Keith Brown L. about the night that Ryan was killed, the questions they still have, and what they feel is necessary to get justice for Ryan. We'll be adding attorney Cindy Short in on that discussion as well. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next is Keith Brown L. and his guest.
This is Keith Brown Ill, and this is the second half of our interview with the Ryan Stokes family. I'm here with his mother, Miss Nareen, one of his closest friends, Laverl Johnson, and Miss Cindy Short, the attorney for the family. I think the first question I'd like to ask you, Miss Nareen, is when did this situation involving Ryan first come to your attention? How were you informed about his death?
I was informed on July 28th, 2013, by calling my second son, because Ryan was my only son. Lover came to my house or knocked on the door.
And that would be Laverl.
Yes. And his voice, his tone, the knock, I'll never ever forget as long as I'm here. To hear Lover just calling out, wanting me to open the door. And
you knew it was trouble when
I could. You just have that mother intuition, that mother sense that something's wrong.
All right, Laverl, could you tell me a little bit about how this first came to your attention?
Well, I was actually asleep. I was at the house, and I got a phone call from my sister, and she was like, Ryan was shot. Well, we call him Fatback. So she's like, Fatback was shot. I'm like, what? I jumped out the bed, and it's like 3 a.m, so I'm like, what are you talking about? And then she said, yeah, he was shot by the police. I kind of dropped the phone, like, what are you talking about? She's like, he gone. Gone what? What are you saying? She's like, then they jumped on him and put handcuffs on him.
They jumped on him after he was shot?
After he was shot, they jumped on him and put the handcuffs on. That's what she said she saw.
Now, when you say they jumped on him, you mean they physically put their bodies on him, or they...
They put their bodies on him and...
Or they physically assaulted him.
He was already shot, so I guess they kind of put their knees on him and put him in cuffs.
And why did you find this particularly shocking? I mean, you knew him as a personal friend. You didn't know him to be the type of person that would ever be involved in a situation where he would end up being shot by the police. Did that fact strike you as being strange?
Yes, it definitely did. I mean, it just made no sense. Shot by the police doing what? Because we lived around the corner from each other, so the whole time I'm trying to go around there, I'm like, man, maybe they mistaken. Maybe they were just arresting him or something. It made no sense, like, for him to be shot by the police. So I just knew I couldn't believe it.
All right, Cindy, could you give us a little bit of information about how you became involved in this case when you learned about it?
Well, I learned about it when Nareen reached out to me and to my husband, and she and Clarence came to us because they had received some information from the police that was not accurate. And once they knew that the police weren't telling them the truth about the death of their son, they needed some help to see if someone could reach out to the police and find out what had happened. Anybody who's victimized like this, information is so important, and certainly accurate information is critical.
Ms. Nareen, when was it that you were finally contacted by the police, and what type of information did they give you about the situation?
The police officially calling me was later on that day, early Sunday morning. So Kansas City Police Department didn't contact me in the evening. They killed him 2-3 in the morning, and they didn't call us until it was about to be dark that day. I remember that. It was hot, and I stayed outside.
Yeah, and there were so many people that loved Ryan so much and that were so afraid and heartbroken, and so all of Ryan's friends
just left in a state of shock.
But they all came to the house to support Nareen and Crystal and Tasha and Clarence. And so there were people in the house, in the front yard, and up and down the streets waiting for news, praying that Ryan was in a hospital, that Ryan was still alive. And the officers, when they came, did it in a way that was very insensitive to this family and to this community.
Now, how many people do you think were out there approximately?
100?
Over. Man, so many.
It was over, really.
Both blocks was filled up with people, so it was a lot of people.
Okay, now, can either of the three of you tell me, what was Ryan doing in the Apollo Light District that time of night on that date?
He was a young man. He was in his early 20s, and the kids like to go down to Power and Light. It's a fun place to be for Ryan and his friends. A lot of their friends are going to be down there, and so on that particular night, Ryan did not have to work the next day. He worked 6 days a week with his dad in the dry cleaning business. But Sunday was a day off, and so I believe one of the group had a birthday around that time.
Yes.
And so the guys, they didn't want to spend any money. That was important because they were about to make a big trip down to Florida, and they'd been saving up their money. So at the end of the evening, a group of friends went down to the Power and Light to kind of walk around, see who they could see, chat with people, you know, just kind of end the night. And they saw a lot of people that they knew. And every single person who saw Ryan that night said he was just the same old fun, not a care in the world. He hadn't had a thing to drink. He was in a good mood. And so he was down there to do what young people do, which is, you know, scope out the girls and talk to the guys and have a good time.
What actually led up to this incident? Can somebody explain it to me, please?
Power and Light was shutting down. And so the people had been told to leave the bars. And it was a very busy night that, because there was a lot of activity because of events. And so the sidewalks were very crowded, and as a group of young white males came out onto the sidewalk, they had been there all night, they'd been having a good time, they'd come in cabs, and so they had an intention to have a good time, and they'd had too much to drink. And one of the young men thought that he had lost his cell phone. And so when he came out onto the sidewalk, he didn't know where it was, and unfortunately, sadly, what he did was he turned to the first African-American man that he saw and accused that man of taking his phone. That was not Ryan, but that was a friend of Ryan's. And there were words exchanged. The white males began to push the guy that they were accusing, and Ryan, actually, in the last video we have of his life, is standing between the white men and the black men and kind of putting his hands out, as I think you've heard about him being a peacemaker. The police, sadly, down at Power and Light overuse, in my view, pepper spray. And so instead of doing anything productive. They just sprayed pepper spray into the crowd. And so you see after the pepper spray is sprayed, a group of young men really jog, not even run, across the street.
To get away from the pepper spray.
Yeah, because as anybody that has had the sad experience of experiencing that, they know it stings your eyes, it burns your skin. So people are just trying to get away from it.
Now, did they spray directly into the crowd, or did they spread into the air and just let it to the
It's
crowd?
Not clear to me. It got on people because people had irritated eyes. The young man that had been accused of stealing the cell phone seemed to get the brunt of it in his face, and so he handed his keys to Ryan and asked Ryan to go get the car. And Ryan headed right up to get the car. And the sad part of this is Ryan was in a white t-shirt. He had cornrows. He's kind of a big guy. And instead of walking to the car, he chose to run to the car. And he did that in part, I believe, because you don't leave your buddy behind, you know, and you have these white men that have just been pushing and shoving and accusing. And so when Ryan got into the parking lot, he had no idea the police wanted to talk to him. And from the time that he left that corner until he was shot and laying on that pavement was less than 3 minutes.
Well, what explanation did they give for wanting to talk to him after they pepper sprayed the crowd to disperse and people were leaving? What was there to talk about if he was leaving the scene?
Well, these white males went up to a bicycle cop and told the cop that their phone had been stolen. And they pointed up the street towards where Ryan was headed to his car. And in fact, pointed past the person that they'd actually accused. And there is no similar description between the two men. One is slightly built, not very tall. And then Ryan was a big guy, and they weren't dressed anything alike. So the white men point up the street towards the police, and then the police decide to do a foot pursuit, a pedestrian check. But they are about 30 or 40 seconds behind Ryan. So Ryan's already turned the corner onto the street where he's going to get his car. He doesn't know that these white guys have pointed up the street. He doesn't know anybody wants to talk. And when he reaches his car is the first time that the officers come into the parking lot from the south side. And I believe Ryan saw them. And then there were officers coming in from the north side, which I do not believe that Ryan was aware of. And it was the officers coming from the north that shot Ryan as he stepped towards the south.
Now, was he shot from the back or the front?
He was shot from the back into his side. So he was shot in the low lateral or behind abdomen. And there were two shots that entered his body. And the kind of ammunition that police use are very damaging once they enter the body. He was really critically injured, and that was clear from the very beginning.
This was an outside parking lot or inside?
It was an outside parking lot. It was a parking lot that is up right across from the Board of Education, a parking lot that I think this group regularly used when they visited Power and Light, a place they had never had any kind of problems before. And when Ryan went to the car was actually backed in. So when you went to the driver's door, you were looking south. And the officer that shot him came in from the north. And you have to remember that this thing happened very, very quickly. And the officer then claimed after the fact that Ryan had a gun. But after he was shot, the officers are yelling, you know, did he have a gun? And when they went over there to cuff him, they discovered that there was no weapon.
They never found any weapon.
Well, there was a weapon in the car, but the car belonged to Ollie, the friend that he was with, and the gun belonged to Ollie, and Ollie legally owned the gun, and the gun was in the car, which is where he left it when the guys got to Power and Light. The gun was never out of that car.
Never on Ryan.
Now, what is the law here in Missouri about carrying weapons? Can you carry them on your person? Or did he do the proper thing by just leaving it in the car?
Oh, he did absolutely the proper thing. That was the legal thing. And Ollie is somebody who works for the federal government. He has never been in trouble. He's worked for the same entity for 8 or 10 years, for a long time. Okay. And so he understands what the rules are about weapons. Like I said, the gun was legally purchased. And in Missouri, you can leave your gun in the car. That is legal. We are one of the more liberal states when it comes to gun ownership and the possession of guns. Now, you'd have to have it carried concealed if you were going to take it out and have it on your person. But there was no intention for that.
Okay, now was the gun in a location where it would have made it impossible for Ryan to have access to it from outside the car?
Well, we know that he didn't have access to it from outside the car because of the testimony of people who were at the scene. And so he didn't get into the car. And the car was in a location where Ollie kept it, was between the driver's seat and the console.
So there was no way he could have actually had it and threw it in the car or anything like that. It seems like it's a pattern that every time the police unjustifiably shoot somebody, they always claim that they had a gun.
Yeah.
You know, whether, regardless of whether it's true or not, I mean, people right. have a matchbook in their hand, they have a right. wallet or right. ink pen, right. a cell phone. It's, right. it's a gun.
And Ryan did have a cell phone and keys in his hand. That is true. But you're right. That is what happens. And the way the law works is they look at the reasonableness of the officer's decision in that moment. And it is not unusual when these events happen that an officer would say after the fact that he thought he saw a gun.
Now, has anybody done any checking into the background of the police officers who were responsible for shooting her? They've been involved in other incidents like this before.
Well, we don't know. What we do know is that the officers that were involved were normally not on patrol. They were officers that were assigned to research and development. And so their normal shift would be during the day and working with whatever research and development people do at the police department. Chief Forte had decided to institute a hot zone policy where he wanted to put every officer, regardless of assignment, onto the street X number of days or nights a year, and he would put them into the hot zones at the hottest times, on the weekends and at night. And so the officer that fired the weapon was not normally out on the streets. And so
he was inexperienced.
The issue would be training. He was an older officer, so I would say he had a lot of experience in terms of being a police officer, but it wasn't his normal assignment to be on patrol in a hot spot.
And he was the sole shooter. Wasn't other officers that fired on
Ryan
as well?
No, just one officer.
Ms. Noreen, I'd like to ask you, at what point did you start feeling that something was being withheld from you in the way of information, that the police were not being completely honest with you about what had taken place?
The first point was when they finally did call me, they asked me could I meet them instead of coming to my home. And I thought something strange there. And then when they get to my home and they tell me that Ryan had a gun, wouldn't put it down, so they had a shooting 5 times in the chest. We go view the body, and it's not in the chest. So why would you tell me that you shot Ryan 5 times in the chest?
He was actually shot 5 times, or how many times was it?
2, but they said 5, and they said in the chest.
And he was shot from behind, into the side.
Yeah. So if I didn't know something was wrong by then, and that's when someone said she needs a lawyer, and I called.
And the other odd thing they did was the show of force when they came to what's called the notice of next of kin. And so instead of recognizing and being empathetic to the loss that had been suffered by all of these people, they appeared with multiple officers in police jackets, weren't they?
They sat around us like it was like we were going to.
Like you were criminals.
Right.
Yeah. And they escorted the detectives to Nareen. It was just a very insensitive way to bring the news of someone's son who had been lost in such a tragic way.
In other words, it's like we the police, and if you start any trouble, we got some methods to deal with you. Now, how many people were with Ryan the night that he died?
No, it was 3 of them for sure. But it was just 2 of them in the car, 2 different cars that was with him.
Now, Cindy, the way you were explaining things to me a while ago, it didn't sound like the people who initiated this conflict got very much of the pepper spray, if they got any at all. It seemed like all the pepper spray was directed at Ryan and his friends.
All we know is from what we can see on the videotape, and from the videotape, it doesn't appear that they are suffering from pepper spray. They were suffering from intoxication, but they weren't suffering from pepper spray.
And were any of Ryan's friends intoxicated?
Nope. They were not.
Did they go into any of the establishments to drink?
No, they didn't. They were walking around the exterior. Because at that late, my understanding is, and again, Lover should be talking about this, but the outside around Power and Light is like a big block party.
Right. We wasn't dressed to basically go into nothing or whatever. So what we do is, you know, like if we just sitting on the block at the house, or we wait till like the functions or whatever let out. So we just go down there and just chat with people that we know. Sometimes we get phone calls or something, be like, oh yeah, so-and-so is down here. So we'll go down there and try to probably talk to them and their friends or some of the dudes we went to school with or so. Basically, I know they just went down there just to hang out.
Yeah.
Would you have normally been with them on that night?
Definitely.
Yeah, you would.
Well, what happened the night that this happened that you met?
The reason I wasn't with them because my girlfriend, I was with her at the time because she had just had a loss. She had just lost her brother the week before, so that's the reason why I wasn't with him.
How long you say you've been doing, Ryan?
Snotty nose. Second grade, third grade.
I've been on him forever.
What happened at the funeral services? Was there a police presence or were you allowed to conduct the services?
I was numb. I couldn't tell you.
I couldn't tell you.
I couldn't tell you. That day was
I know
after the services, they were still on the
they had all the blocks like cut off with cops on each corner, like you couldn't exit the blocks without them watching over us, basically. It was crazy.
Well, the service was very well attended. So Zion Grove is a fairly large church, and the sanctuary is big. And it was a full house and standing room only. And people told me it looked kind of like a big parking lot. It was like a concert. There were so many cars. And people that Ryan had known his whole life and that Nareen and the family didn't even know he was still having contact with. And the good deeds that he had done with people. I mean, there were so many people that wanted to say goodbye.
Now, we had a conversation earlier. You were telling me about the statistics on the police shootings here in Kansas City. Could you relate it to the audience again?
Sure.
And about the people who have had litigations and how many of them have been successful and how many have not?
Well, in Kansas City, we know from the recent investigative report that was done by the Kansas City Star that we've suffered 47 individuals have been killed in officer-involved shootings.
In how, what period of time?
In over a 10-year period. Over that period, there have been no indictments of any officer, so every shooting was judged to be justified by the prosecutor. There have been 11 lawsuits filed in those 47 cases. 9 of those lawsuits have been dismissed by the courts, and 2 survive. And so the statistics in terms of accountability or getting justice or getting the police to change policies like the foot pursuit policy is hard to achieve when the courts are not helping you.
We're almost out of time, but before we end this interview, I'd like to ask, is there anything that you want to tell the audience, Cindy or Noreen or anybody, have anything that they like the audience to know that I haven't asked you about?
I would love to let all the people know that Ryan was no way what the police say or what the media had tried to say at first. I hope they really hear us, that we're trying to speak out and get the grand jury to open the case back up. It's not justifiable to me. It's unjustified.
And we need to say that, too, if you want to learn more about this case, you need to visit the Facebook page for Ryan. So if you put in Ryan Stokes, you'll also be able to learn a lot about his life through the interviews of family members and friends who have given testimonials. And we would certainly invite anybody to like page and to get involved. We will continue to be doing events. We'll continue to be in the community. And we would love people to stand up with us.
We had that petition out.
Yes.
That Cindy started. Yeah.
Basically, I just want to say that, I mean, Ryan Stokes was a good dude. And the character that they put on him, that wasn't him at all.
That seems like that's a typical strategy when you have these type of incidents, to go in and try to destroy the person and discredit the victim and make him look like he's a monster so they can make people feel that they were justified in taking the action that they took. And I think that's something that needs to be paid more attention to. And I hope that people will be more aware of this when they go into these situations. They're asked to decide the facts in the case. And I'd like to thank everybody for participating in this interview. I think it's very important that the public knows what's going on in these type of situations. And we look forward to possibly hearing from you again.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Eric Sterling, the director of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, was my guest on last week's Cultural Baggage program. Eric, I want to interject the thought that it is in California, or certainly in Oakland, where they are making arrangements for those who were previously arrested, incarcerated for marijuana sales or growth, to actually become part of that industry, which is a step in that direction, right?
I think that's a very positive corrective step. It seems absurd to me to say that people who were selling drugs illegally now can't get involved in this industry when it's legal. As long as they follow the rules in this new industry, they have a passion for it. They shouldn't be disqualified because they have a drug conviction, in my opinion.
No, I would agree. There's a similar scenario up in Canada where all of the people who helped change the laws, helped change perspectives insofar as cannabis, are now being denied the ability to participate in the industry. It's just not right.
Well, many states have cannabis laws. Like in Maryland, the medical cannabis law forbids people who had a felony drug conviction from working in the legal medical cannabis industry in Maryland.
I don't understand the logic, but again, there's not much logic in drug war laws in the first place. Well, Eric, I know you have worked with the U.S. Congress. Congressman Peter Rodino, was that it? The year was 86, about, was it, sir?
So, in 1986, a Maryland basketball star who was very, very well known inside the Beltway signed with the Boston Celtics, who had won the NBA championship. And the night that he signed with the Celtics, he came back home and he was partying and he died from a cocaine seizure in his dormitory at the University of Maryland. This really shocked the country and it shocked members of Congress. And the Speaker of the House, who was from Boston, Tip O'Neill, figured out that perhaps the Democrats could take advantage of the drug issue instead of the Republicans. A huge Democratic-inspired drug bill was put together. I was the drugs guy for the House Judiciary Committee, and so I was drafted into these meetings, and I was involved in writing what became the very infamous mandatory minimum drug sentences in 1986. Those laws, consistently we found that they were being disproportionately imposed against people of color by federal prosecutors around the country. The U.S. Department of Justice has been outrageous in the way it has prosecuted low-level offenders and given them the sentences that Congress made a tremendous mistake in imposing long sentences for small quantities. In 2010, there was an effort to fix this. It only changed the small quantities of crack cocaine slightly so that the five-year sentence is triggered by 28 grams, about an ounce, instead of 5 grams. But the focus was never on high-level offenders, and so still low-level offenders are getting long sentences and very long sentences.
Up to 20 years and beyond at times.
Way beyond. Life. I mean, Clarence Allen, who was let out a couple of years ago, had his sentence commuted by President Obama. Clarence Allen was a college student who drove some cocaine to his cousin's business in Mobile, Alabama. He got 3 life sentences running consecutively because he didn't plead guilty.
This is Ray Hill, and I'm a guest on the show.
Good work you've done over the years. I've heard all about you, man.
Oh, really? And you read those wanted posters at the post office, apparently. I started in mass incarceration, and the idea was to reduce sentences. And, of course, the first target is your mandatory minimum laws. Because I was of the opinion that federal judge friends of mine were telling me, well, Raymond, I can't do anything. My hands are tied.
Right.
And so we had this ongoing conversation with them. And so I told Eric, and of course, you know, I'm selling a hog here. So I may not be 100% right, but I said, basically what you're getting is really low-level people and mules. You're not really touching the people in the business.
This was documented very thoroughly by the U.S. Sentencing Commission in their report to Congress in 2007. This is online. You can look in the data. 1/3 of the federal crack cases involved less than 25 grams, less than an ounce.
Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars just flushed away because our nation is just so scared. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope that you have enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. This is Jeff Humfeld, and our outro music is Better Man, from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesdays, Alternative Radio on Wednesdays, a mix of national and local programming on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Dr. Mike's Morning Medicine Show, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio at 6 p.m.